Hey everyone, I am Reva and just want to take a moment and thank you for listening to our studio podcast. Although we are here in Greenville, South Carolina, we are grateful for your support to see the message of Jesus go out all over the world. In case you are not aware, we have a YouTube channel, which you can find the link in our podcast bio. We hope you enjoy this week's talk and it encourages you and it helps you to be the human God designed you to be. So with that, let's get right to it.
All right. How many have been here at least once in the last 3 to 4 weeks? Put it up proudly. Put it up. Okay. How many have not been here in the last 3 or 4 weeks? This is not to shame you. This is just to get an idea. Okay. The reason I say that, because we are actually in the fourth part of a series that is, I call them accidental series. The way my brain works, once I open a room, I step into a room, I just exhaust the room until it's done. And I don't know when this one is done. So we're actually 4 weeks into a topic, an idea. And it's important for us to be aware of that, because if you're visiting for the first time or you haven't been here all the weeks, everything is on the podcast. So if there's pieces that you're like, well, what was that? What was that? Go back and listen to it, because they're all very interconnected and they're a big building block building towards something. And so just understand that. And I didn't have you raise your hand if you haven't been here to shame you. I just want to get an idea of how many of you have some context for what we've been talking about. But we've been going after some fun stuff. How many would say that you've been here, have been challenged in a deep way? Put your hand up if that's you. Quite a few of you. Well, good, because that's my intent. Is I want us to think deeply about things that sometimes we just assume everyone thinks the same way. And so I am focusing on large assumptions or strongly held beliefs that we have, and I'm forcing us to actually take a relook at some core things that really do determine what you do in your daily life. And if you are young, old, and in between, I want to encourage you, stay engaged with me. We're going to keep going today. I have slides, so don't worry if the information becomes a lot of data. Your phone is one of the best tools that you have. You can take pictures of the screen. And I know the last few weeks that had been very common. My goal is to be very clear, very linear, and just lay this thing out as clear as possible for multiple reasons, to kind of give you a heads up on who we are, where we're going, and why we do what we do. But on a more important level, I want to help you think deeply about some things that it may have been a while since you thought about it, or maybe for some, you have never actually thought about it in this way. So that is my goal. So today, I'm going to continue to challenge you. So look at your neighbor and say, Eric's about to challenge you. Some of your tones aren't good, by the way, when you said that. But that is, for some reason, I just have a part of me that just wants to challenge the way we think about things. So I'm sorry. I apologize beforehand. I will always do that. It's just my nature. And I believe it's part of the staying curious. I believe it's part of where God's taking us. And I'm doing my very best to help us move forward into what God has called us. I am not a preserver of history. I want to create the future. And that's what I'm passionate about. And so that's what we're doing, okay? That sound good? All right. Have you ever seen a painter have a blank canvas and the excitement and the terrifying feeling that they have of what that first brushstroke is going to be, what color it's going to be? Because once you start that brushstroke, it begins to create something. And almost for some artists, it's the point of no return. Have you ever seen a writer sit down and piece of paper or laptop or any device and in a cabin in the woods and they want to write, and yet there's this excitement, but there's also this terrifying reality. What's my first sentence? Because oftentimes that first sentence determines the course of the book. And it's terrifying because you could spend days and weeks and months writing, putting words down, and you get 10,000 words in and you realize this is not at all what I was trying to do. So you got to scratch it, throw it away, and start all over. Have you ever seen a musician sit down and they've got some ideas of some melodies, some harmonies, and some words, and they're trying to put it together, and it's, for some songs come easy, and honestly, a lot of them, it's a lot of work. to refine it. And I'm around songwriters, as Reva mentioned, and we got lots of songwriters here, and I get the privilege of seeing and hearing some of the songs in process. And what I love is sometimes it's one word. We need a different word here, and weeks and months go by, and the song's not done because of one word. But maybe it's one line. It doesn't transition well. It doesn't sing well. It doesn't communicate well. And that's what we do as humans. We create. We create things. We take ideas and we put them out. We take them from the ethereal dimension, from the dimension that is intangible, you can't see, and you find a way to make sense of it. Have you ever seen a chef stand in front of a set of ingredients and produce and protein and different ingredient, and they're having to figure out what to create out of this? And when they begin to put the ingredient together and they can create flavor profiles that blow our minds, that you would never guess. And some of the most remarkable creations in culinary arts is you see it and you think it tastes this way, but when you bite into it, it tastes like something completely different than you expected. And it catches you by surprise. You're in awe. I'm deeply inspired by chefs, and every time I watch Chef's Table or other shows, I'm like, I think I found my calling in life, is to be a chef. Or then I watch shows about physicists or scientists or mathematicians, and I think, man, I wish I was a mathematician. I'm just that kind of guy. I just get so easily inspired, and I had a really bad algebra teacher that kind of ruined math for me, and I haven't fully recovered. But that's an entirely different story, and it's a true story. But each of us, we actually create, we design, we do things in our life to leave our mark, to leave our imprint, to make a difference, to impact. There's a great phrase out there, said, I want to make a dent on humanity. And I hope somewhere deep inside you, there's this longing, there's this desire to actually make a difference in this world. I know that resonates with some, but I hope it's all in this room. Whether it's just something small or something so grandiose, you don't even know how it's going to happen. Regardless, I hope each of you are sitting here today with this idea, this dream, this longing to actually do something in your life that is last beyond your timeline, that it affect the generation that you haven't met yet. I hope something in you, at least by the end of the talk today or at some point in your life, you wake up with this newfound passion, this newfound dream. Like, I don't want to just live a normal life. I actually want to do something meaningful. And I want to do something that outlasts me. And I want to do something that eternity will tell if I impacted generations after me. One of the most beautiful passages in Scripture is when David, the life of David, and 400 years later, God is not too happy with the current leadership. And he says something to this effect, I want to destroy you, but I'm not going to because of your father, David. David wasn't the actual father. It was the great, 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 great. He was 400 years removed from that moment. But you see, your legacy can impact a generation that you've never seen. That even when God is not too stoked about how you're doing, he says, you know what? I'm going to go light on you because of who went before you. I hope you wake up in the morning with that sense that that's your reality, that that is your possibility to actually leave a mark in such a way that generations later, they're protected, if you will. They are steered, their invitation generations later to turn their hearts back because of your decision, because of your life, and because of what you have done with who you are. Today, I want to talk a continuation. The title of today's talk is Culture is a Canvas. Culture is a Canvas. We've been building this thing over the last few weeks, and today I want to focus specifically within culture. And I want to move it from the interesting thing about these conversations we've been having for the last few weeks is there's certain definitions with certain terms, and as I've interacted with many of you, when I say one word, you think it means one thing, and when I say it, I mean another thing. So it's a lot of the linear approach to just try to set some definitions and some frameworks in place. So when we say these words and what studio is about, that we understand what we're referencing. And so sometimes it's an adjustment on my part, sometimes it's an adjustment on your part. And the word culture is fascinating because I think if we were to take a poll, all of us would have a different definition or a different sense of what, quote, culture actually is. And so today, my goal is to actually move it into a neutral space and move it away from some other spaces that I think are more normalized today. And I don't know if we fully understand how normalized our thinking is on this word called culture. So today, I want to move it into a neutral space, and I want to move it into a not static, but something, it is what it is. And so the first question I want to ask you today is, what is your relationship with culture? What is your relationship with culture? I asked this question beginning of the year when we did our generosity series. I said, what is your relationship with money? How would you define your relationship with money? And for some, it was fear. I'm scared of money, or I feel like there's lack. I'm always constantly, man, there's not enough. And some of you, you don't treat it with much respect. It's just kind of this thing. And there's some of you, greed. I just really long and lust and am greedy for money. And then some of us is more generous. And so we all have this unique relationship with these different things. And so today I want to bring that same idea of question into your heart and mind. And for you to ask yourself, what is your relationship with the word or the idea of culture? Does it excite you? Or is it this repulsive, like, nah, I'm good. I can live, quote, without it. I don't even want to be engaged or interact with it. Well, for maybe some of you, it's very exciting. It's a whole world of infinite possibilities of what can take place. And there's just about endless answers to that question. But for right now, I want you to take a moment and think about, what is your relationship with culture? How do you look at it? How do you view it? If someone said, what is the emotion connected to culture? Find some language for that. Some of you could be kind of flat. For some of you, it's confusing. It's chaos. It's scary. Some of you, man, it's fun. It's beautiful. There's so much amazing things going on. So the opening question today I want you to ask is, what is your relationship with culture? I want you to look at culture as an ecosystem of human contribution. It isn't evil and it isn't good. It's just what it is. Now, the moment we add an adjective to the word culture, then our definition become a little more specific. So pop culture. What are we talking about? Pop culture. The word pop is short for popular. So whatever's trending, whatever pop culture. So we take this idea of this, it is what it is. And then we add a word to it to describe it. We can say Latin culture. What are we referring by Latin culture? We're saying, oh, it's the part of culture that is primarily around Latin ideology, Latin emotion, Latin culture, the warm climates, and usually go to the southern hemisphere for that. And then you can go to Norwegian culture. I have Norwegian in my blood, so when I go to Norway, there's so much resonance happening in me when I'm in this country because I'm like, it makes so much sense. So there's different culture. And then we have other words like dysfunctional cultures. Some of us are like, yeah, that's real for me. My family was a dysfunctional culture. And other of you could be a broken culture. So what do? We take this thing that's real. It is what it is. It's not good. It's not bad. It is what it is. But once you start adding words to it, then we start defining what culture actually is. Today, I want to move you away from it being good or bad to move it to a neutral space and recognize it's actually a canvas for you to write about, to write on. It's a canvas for you to create. It's a canvas for you to change the story that's taking place in culture as we speak. It's important to understand what your relationship to culture is because that will determine your posture and how you approach this concept of culture. And we've been unpacking the last few weeks how you think the story ends in the end will determine what you do today. Today, I want to bring it down to a more smaller level. The way you interact and you define your relationship with this idea of culture will actually determine what posture you have as you engage with culture. So your posture toward culture will determine your presence in it. However you define that. The irony of this, though, to me, is if you truly believe everything ends in destruction, if your, quote, eschatology, it's going to burn up in the end, it's very intriguing to me. And the irony for me is this, is I interact with people saying it's going to burn in the end, but they're really upset at the current condition it's in. My point is, if it's going to burn, let it burn. Why are you upset about it? Because I believe deep within your soul, you know you can do something about it. You just feel powerless. So I want to just put before you, for those of you that maybe more lean toward it's going to be destroyed in the end, then you probably shouldn't complain about it because what you think is going to happen is actually happening. Are you guys tracking with me? So I want to just put before you, if you're bothered by what's happening in culture, I would propose something deep within you long to do something about it. You just don't know how to go about it. I actually am convinced when you complain about something, it's because you have the solution. It's just a lot easier to complain. It is so simple to complain and grumble about something. It takes no effort. The hard part is to find the solution to the thing that you're complaining about. And sadly, we don't take enough time and due diligence to actually go, what is the solution to this thing that drives me crazy? And if we take a week, I can't figure it out, then we just resort right back to complaining, judging, ridiculing, and criticizing when actually we had an invitation to go on a journey to find the solution that God has actually placed within us. So if you find yourself complaining about things in culture, reframe that and go, wow, the solution must be in here somewhere. I now have permission to go on a journey to find it. That was really good, by the way, but I'll just let that slide. I want you to look at culture as a breathing, living organism. I don't want you to look at it as something flat and dead. When I say culture is what it is, understand that cities are breathing in and out. Neighborhoods are living organisms. Your work environment aren't just static. They're living and breathing. Some days are beautiful. Some days they're not good. What does that mean? It means you have to cultivate culture. It's not something you set and it's final for the... No, it's something you cultivate. Like the culture in my marriage is something that my wife and I have cultivated and given our life to. So it's not some static, dead thing. It's actually living and breathing. So I want you to look at culture in whatever context you're looking at. Understand it's breathing. It's alive. It's an organism. It's something that can be cultivated, pruned, fertilized, fostered. It's something that can be watered or not watered. It's living and breathing. I want you to change your perspective on culture because then you begin to realize how much impact you can actually have on this idea. Culture is not a threat to our faith. And I think so many of us have bought into culture is a threat to my faith. Let me just say something right now. Do you know how many dictators, authoritarians, really bad wars? So many plans have been tried to diminish the Christian faith. What's fascinating about our faith, the more attack it gets, the more it excels. And sometimes we think, oh, it's a threat to our faith. No, it's not. It's a threat to you, but it's not a threat to our faith. Jesus is not threatened by the evil in this world. I think we feel threatened. I think this is important because if we actually feel threatened, most people will react accordingly. And I believe Jesus invites us into a different way to interact with culture. Is anybody still with me still? Okay. Go ahead and put up the next slide. Today I want to talk about these three ideas. I want to present them to you to get you to think deeply. We're going to start with theology of culture. I'll explain that in just a minute. And then we're going to drop down into two different I would say, views or framework of how you can engage and interact with culture. So if you have your phone, get them out, because there are going to be some slides and you can review them. And I know that these are initiating very great conversations in our church right now. And I'm glad for that, because I believe it's something we can interact on. So I want to start with theology of culture. So go to the next slide. The aim of the theology of culture is this, is to explore how our Christian faith interact and engage with the world around us. It's the study. It's how does our faith interact with that? Now, where do we go for our source information? The ultimate source information is the scriptures. The beautiful thing about the Bible is we have a very complex history of relationship with faith and culture. So for our context, we have to understand we are on this side of the cross. We are in what is called the New Covenant. So our best source material for understanding how our faith interacts with culture is in the New Testament, in the New Covenant. And to even bring it down to a finer point is how Jesus interacted with humanity and culture. That is our best source material. Any other source material after that isn't less in a... It's less important. It's still important, but I want to just draw our attention back. We must look at the life of Jesus and let that be the source material for how we understand how our faith interacts with culture. We don't go, this is how I interact with culture, and where in Jesus' life does it validate that? No, we look at the life of Jesus and we make adjustments accordingly to how he affected and impacted and engaged with culture. Are you with me on that? The challenge is we like to find the parts of Jesus we like, and then the parts we don't like, I don't have to do with that. I'm just going to ignore that for now. We can't do that. We can't afford to do that. Our lives require to some degree to go, how did Jesus do this across the board? If you want to understand how to interact with culture, look at Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 and Matthew 6. That is a manual, a playbook of how to interact with culture and humanity. So theology of culture is that's what it wrestles with. It's how our faith interacts with human culture. And then we're also looking how does God reveal himself in culture? So we're looking at that, not just how interact, but how does God reveal himself in culture and through culture? And then lastly, but not leastly, how should Christians live within and engage and shape culture? Which leads us to do, what is the role of art? What is the role of work? What is the role of politics? What is the role of family, entrepreneurship, all these different expressions of humanity? What is that role of all those activities? What does it play into the study of how our faith interacts with culture? I have a few slides that will help you to give some framework. So go to the next slide. The first thing to realize, it starts with creation, not crisis. When we look at how our faith, how God interact with human culture, he started with creation, not crisis. Theology of culture doesn't begin with what's wrong with the world. It begins with God's original blessing. We must return back to a Genesis 1 perspective of how we look at culture and how we look at the world. And it can be found in verse 26. God said, and it was good, very good. Now, some of you say, what about sin? You're right. Sin is another conversation that we can't dive into very deeply today. But I'm trying to bring your attention to God actually said, this is good. So when he talked about human culture, he actually blesses it in Genesis 1. Now, obviously, we know in Genesis 3, when sin comes in, it changes a few things. But the purpose of the cross and redemption was to bring it back to its original intent, which is how it affects us. We understand the ramifications of sin in our own lives and the sin within a larger culture, but we still have to view it the way God views it for the purpose of redemption and renewal. Are you guys still with me? The impulse to create, design, build, and steward is woven into our humanity. We can't help but do those things. This isn't about winning a culture back. It's about participating in God's renewal of all things. Let's go to the next slide. There's two words on the screen, engagement over domination. Engagement over domination. Embracing dominion in Genesis 1:28 as stewardship more than domination. Now, some of you might not be aware, but there's a very strong framework that would be called, loosely called, dominion theology. And it derives from the verse in Genesis where God told Adam and Eve, take dominion over everything. So the word dominion is taken to the extent that our job as Christians, as people of the faith, is to be in dominion and to authoritatively guide everything in culture. I would propose that is not what God is referring to, because when you look at taking dominion, the way you see it play out in Adam's life is he was naming animals, Adam and Eve were naming animals, he was cultivating the garden and stewarding what God had put before them. Are you guys with me still? Okay. Jesus engaged the culture of his day, but never grasping for political control. His power in the cross, it wasn't coercive. The early church had zero political power, yet reshaped the known world through love, sacrifice, and creativity. What I don't want you to hear me say, we should not be involved in politics. That's not what I'm saying. I'm simply just drawing your attention to the reality that the church, early church had zero political power, but yet they changed everything. This is important because I'll hopefully unpack it more later and if not in the future. So I don't want anyone in here to think, well, we shouldn't be involved in politics. I know people in this room, they're like, you have a passion to serve in politics. You have passion to whether to be governor or be a Congress or be a president someday. And I'm all for that. I really am. Believe it or not, I believe there are people, that is the world they need to enter. So please don't misunderstand me thinking we shouldn't be involved in politics. No, it's very, very important. But on a fundamental level, understand that it is engagement over domination. And I believe through politics, it's very difficult in our current political system, but I believe you can engage and see transformation from within the political spectrum instead of a dominion authoritative approach. I love how quiet it is in here. And you know what that means to me? You're all thinking, and I love that. Next slide. Faithful presence over forceful influence. Now you see the little V in the middle? I lean more towards faithful presence instead of forceful influence. Faithful presence means this. It plays the long game. If you're looking for instant results in 1 week of engaging with culture, faithful presence thinks, no, I'm here for the long haul. My goal is to do as much as I can do in my lifetime and hand it to the next generation. That's the approach. That's the mindset. It means showing up over time with beauty, integrity, and excellence in your domain, whether it's education, business, design, parenting, policy, and that list really is endless. The way you think about faithful presence instead of forceful influence, think of Daniel in Babylon. And if you're unaware, Daniel was in Babylon for over 70 years under three different kings, very evil, corrupt, dysfunctional, broken men, and Daniel served underneath all of them. He didn't attempt to overthrow the empire, but he found ways to reveal God within the empire. Next slide. Culture is not something we own, it's something that we steward. Culture, the shared space, it's not the churches to reclaim or the world to corrupt, it's God's to redeem. As image bearers, we don't own culture, we cultivate it. And I love that passage in Psalms 24:1. It says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. Next slide. This one I think will help some of you to keep listening to me. Because the challenge when we say the word culture, oftentimes we think immorality, worldliness, sin, evil. This is why I want to take some time at the beginning to say culture is none of that. That is what sin does to it. But culture is the expression of the human soul, what's going on inside. It's our contribution to this customs and culture. So today, when you hear culture, I'm not talking about worldliness. So this slide is to help you understand there's a difference between the two. Worldliness is not being in culture. It's being formed by culture without being formed by Christ. Daniel in Babylon served in government without compromising his faith. Over 70 years of one of the most corrupt empires known to man. Whenever you hear Babylon, there's nothing good about it. And Daniel was able to serve in there for over 70 years and not compromise. Paul in Athens. Paul quoted secular poets and pointed people to Jesus. You'd be amazed at how many things are happening in the culture of humanity that actually point right back to Jesus. You know how many prophetic words took place in the Old Testament that were not prophesied by people that follow God? You'd be amazed at how many little moments where God uses somebody. If he can use a donkey, he can use anything on earth to prophesy of what he wants to do. Jesus at the wedding, he made wine, not a purity statement. Culture is not the enemy. Sin is the enemy. Okay, you guys still with me? Okay, so I gained some of you back on that point. Good, I'm glad. Next slide. This is just a nice little table for you to see the contrast between culture and worldliness. Culture, the neutral human-made environment, includes art, work, design, politics, food, language, and systems. A medium for God's revelation to be engaged and shaped. What I'm trying to do is put culture into this framework that is actually a medium where God wants to meet people and he wants to reveal himself. When you look at worldliness, it's a spiritual posture of rebellion. It includes pride, greed, consumerism, idolatry. It's a system that resists God's authority and it's to be discerned and resisted. Let's go to the next slide. Actually, hold off on the next slide. I want to state today that culture is not a threat. It's our canvas. For some of you, it might take some time to move into that framework. I am simply proposing that we actually look at culture differently, not as a threat, but it's actually something God wants to reveal himself in. And guess who gets to be invited into that? You and me. The long-term antidote to cultural confusion is not censorship. It's not boycott. It's a fundamentally rooted in the idea that formation in Christ is what makes you resilient within culture. I think one of the big missing pieces for some of us when we think about culture is we're actually concerned about being shaped and formed by it rather than being shaped and formed by Jesus. The antidote to all of this confusion is you and I continue passionately down this road of being shaped and formed by Jesus, because he's the one that allowed us to be resilient within the context of culture. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Now I want to talk about culture war versus culture care. We just went over kind of a broad stroke of theology of culture, how our faith looks at it, interacts with it, hopefully proposing some new framework. Now I want to drop down into two sub-levels called culture war and culture care. This is definitely, I'm presenting this to you, and I lean more towards one, and I will explain that. But I want you to look at this as different ways to look at culture. So we're going to go to the next slide. Let me define culture war for you before I get ahead of myself. Culture war is polarized struggle for social, moral, and political dominance, often framed as a battle between the good and evil within a society. In Christian contexts, culture war theology interprets culture engagement as primarily as a fight to preserve or reclaim moral and political influence through power, policy, and public confrontation. That is somewhat of a definition for culture war. Now let's go to the next slide. Here are some key traits for a culture war framework. It's rooted in fear of cultural loss rather than hope for cultural renewal. It prioritizes ideological purity and political control over gospel witness. It frames opponents as enemies. I just need to highlight this one here. One of the biggest struggles I've had for the last 10 to 12 years is how many people we've made out to be enemies. Anybody that we don't agree with, they're our enemy. They're our enemy. They're our enemy. Whenever you have an ideology that's rooted in good versus evil or they're our enemy, you lean more toward this is a war. And that's what motivates this kind of framework. As long as you keep the enemy a human, you keep Satan out of the picture. I'm going to leave that one there for now. Framed opponents and enemies, not neighbors to be loved or people to be redeemed. one of our greatest challenges today in America is that we look at people we disagree with, people that have destructive agendas, and actually look at them the way God would look at them. It doesn't mean we become naive or passive. It's just that the way we posture our heart toward them is drastically different than that's our enemy. I'm going to keep going. Reduces faith to moral positions and partisan platforms. It seeks to win culture by force or legislation rather than incarnational presence, which means in the flesh, being present in the flesh in the middle of it. The challenge with culture war, I would propose our problem with this approach is this. Culture war theology tries to fight the battle of the kingdom using outrage, coercion, and domination. This is the challenge with this view. It only has one way to, quote, succeed. But the way of Jesus is not to defeat culture, but to redeem it and to reshape it through love, beauty, truth, creativity, and spirit-empowered presence. Okay, now let's go to the next slide. I want to define culture care. Culture care is a redemptive approach to culture engagement. It's redemptive instead of dominate. Some of the key traits of culture care is rooted in hope of renewal, not in fear of decline. It prioritizes presence, beauty, and imagination over control or conquest. It sees culture not as an enemy to be defeated, but as soil to be tended, however fractured. It embraces the full imago Dei, which is the image of God. It embraces that in others, even those who we disagree with. It believes transformation not comes by force, but by faithful witness in the flesh presence and the power of the Holy Spirit. I want to say this. Culture care doesn't ignore evil. It just refuses to become it. It refuses to mirror it. Culture war mirrored the strength of the attack. Culture care refuses to mirror that evil, and it approaches it very differently. Now, I understand some in here are wrestling with, well, it feels like cultural care doesn't address that there's issues and problem. You're right. That is actually not what culture care means. Culture care does not mean cultural naivety. Are you guys still alive? Culture care does not mean cultural naivety. So go to that slide, please. The next one. This is a chart that I want you to see. And again, it's long. I'm just take a picture and you can look at it later. I just want to highlight some of them. It sees culture as a canvas for redemption. Culture care. Culture war sees culture as a battlefield for control. Culture care embraces the posture of presence. Culture war operates from posture of power. Culture care engages through beauty, creativity, and integrity. Culture war engages through conflict, fear, and outrage. A couple more. Culture care sees culture as shared and sacred. Culture war sees culture as secular and hostile. Culture care is rooted in hope and renewal. Culture war is rooted in fear and nostalgia. So I want to just emphasize again, culture care does not mean we become naive and passive. One of the misunderstandings of culture care that it's soft, it's naive, it's passive, or it's blind to the presence of sin. I am not up here today that just become saying that we should just become blind or naive or passive to the evidence of sin and evil that's taking place in our day in America, here, and around the world. What I am saying, we just choose to reflect the darkness that is trying to come at us. We refuse to mirror the tactics of what it's trying to do. And you see this in the life of Jesus. You see it throughout his entire life. He refused to respond the way that he was attacked. And how many would think Jesus was passive? I don't think he was passive. When you die on the cross, that evidence you're not passive. What's my point? Jesus actually looked at culture from a redemptive, from a renewal, from a healing posture instead of a war posture. In fact, he had to tell his disciples to chill out a few times. Hey, Jesus, we want to burn this place up with fire. And he said, we ain't doing that anymore. We're done with that approach. This is how we're going to do it. So Jesus actually presents a different way to address the sin and evil within culture. He just chose not to mirror the tactics of culture. So caring for culture is not the same as excusing it. It's the decision to stay present, to stay hopeful, and to creative and be creative within the brokenness. Culture care acknowledges that there are distortions, that truth is twisted, that there is decay, and that there is despair. But instead of waging war against as an enemy, culture care chooses to contend for its renewal. So another way to say it would be, instead of fighting against people, we're fighting for people. I know you want to fight against people. I can tell. I can feel it. Like, I don't want to. I get it. I get that drive. But I'm going to tell you, that is not a biblical framework. That is an American modern framework. We just got to fight them. No, we fight for people. That's what we do. Now, I understand some of you are sitting here, you have 5,000 questions. Well, what about this? What about this? There are so many. My goal isn't to present two views and draw a hard line and say you never. No, I'm just saying here are different ways to look at the world today. This is not doctrine for me. This is, hey, I want to lean more in the direction of renewal, redemption, and fight for humanity than to do the opposite. Now, there are situations, because we live in a broken world for thousands and thousands of years, there is a decay in humanity that's evident. I wouldn't say in all aspects, but there's definitely decay. So you might be sitting thinking, well, what about laws that need to be passed to protect children from X, Y, and Z? To be honest with you, I think that's beautiful. There is a place for that because there's culture so broken. And in the meantime, there are some things that have gotten so off track. What I want to address is more of the heart posture of how do you view humans and how do you view culture. And if you're viewing it as an enemy, it's a war, I want to encourage you, move away from that and move over here, and I believe you'll start getting some tactics from how Jesus actually, when you read scripture, you'll see how Jesus actually impacted culture with zero political power. So this is not doctrine. I'm going to say that very clear. Doctrine is a set of statements that this is the only way it is. There's no other option. This is not doctrine. These are just strong convictions that I want to encourage us as a community to lean more towards redemption, healing, more toward we are agents of renewal everywhere we go, whether we work at a coffee shop, we're a CEO, we're a doctor, we're at our home, whatever space you occupy, that you would step into that space, that we're not in war, we're actually here to see renewal, to reestablish, to rebuild, to bring hope back to humanity instead of the opposite, that we wouldn't be driven by fear, that we wouldn't be driven by those narratives. We'd be driven by the idea that God uses culture to reveal himself, and he wants to renew culture from within. This is what I want to put before you as the church, as the communities. What we've been doing the last 3 or 4 weeks is for us to look at the world very differently. Why don't you stand?
Thanks for listening to today's talk. If you're interested in learning more about Studio here in Greenville, you can go check out our website, studiogreenville.com, and you can give us a follow on Instagram. Our handle is studio.greenville. Have a great week.